You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on this beautiful Thursday here in Washington, D.C. A lot coming up on our program today. We're going to talk a lot about the Occupy movement. I want to mention a few things about what happened last night in the Republican debate, but frankly, what was it? E.E. Cummings, we are the hollow men. We are the straw men, was his poem. I forget which was the title. And at the very end, it says, this is the way the world will end. This is the way the world will end. This is the way the world will end. Not with a bang, but a whimper. And I would say that was that's probably the best description of what happened last night in the Republican debates. We'll get to a short commentary on that. But frankly, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it today. The amazing news about oil speculation and why the price of gasoline is going up. I want to share that with you. Rick Santorum quoting the bell curve author. That's rather interesting. Some of these tax proposals. What's going on in Ohio? Did you know that the right to work for less law is now being challenged in court? We're going to get to that. UC Davis students who've been pepper sprayed are fighting back in court. Get the frack out of our city. Dryden, New York has actually had their ban on fracking in their city upheld by the New York State Supreme Court. We're going to get to that. And Defense of Marriage Act, John Boehner taking your tax dollars to keep this thing going. Even though on Wednesday, yesterday, District Court in Northern California struck it down. So lots of stuff that we're going to be getting to as we go through the next 3 hours of this program. But first, Robert Stevens II is on the line with us. He's with Occupy DC. OccupyDC.org is the website. And he was on our evening TV show some time back, and we had a fascinating conversation that just began to scratch the surface. And I wanted to get Robert back on and talk with him some more about this whole concept of diversity of tactics, shall we say. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Thank you for joining us. Let's just start at the beginning. Anarchy and diversity of tactics. You want to define some terms for us?
Sure. Anarchism, there wouldn't be a singular way to define that term, but basically it's best looked at in its practices. So if you look at what we conventionally call the Occupy movement, a lot of anarchist practices that we've seen are the non-hierarchy or the horizontal kind of structure, social structure.
Right.
So we had an anti-authority stance in which it was a leaderless movement and all these different kinds of things. That's an anarchist principle and practice. Mm-hmm. We also had a dedication to the idea of autonomy. That meaning, in not individualism in the sense of, you know, you're separate from the community.
Like libertarianism.
You're on your own, buddy.
But a little bit different.
Yeah.
It's a relationship between the self and the community, and that they're both equally important,
mm-hmm.
and that they both stand in equal relationship with one another.
Right.
That's an anarchist principle, and we put it into action. We tried to put it into action in this movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so those would be a couple of little ways of describing anarchism as a principle, and it's also the way that it differs from libertarianism, in my opinion, would be that anarchism requires a dedication to anti-oppression, right? So that's the point.
Right.
It involves struggling against oppression is a fundamental principle.
Whereas libertarianism, in a way, embraces oppression as long as it's oppression by corporations and not by government.
Yeah, kind of. It seems to go into that direction. Like Ron Paul definitely does not have an anti-oppression or social justice lens in his analysis,
right.
And so his type of that's why I would say his type of individualism and that libertarianism promotes would be a little bit different than the kind of community building that anarchism
now
promotes.
I've observed a few General Assemblies, and while the theory of everybody having a say sounds really nice, and if there's 8 or 10 people there, it's very easily done. But the ones that I've seen where there are more than 100 people, there's one person who's standing up at the front and basically calling on people or recognizing motions, and very often seems to ignore some people and choose other people, that person has an enormous amount of power. How do you reconcile that with the idea of nobody being in charge?
Well, what you're talking about is facilitation.
Yes.
And so there are good facilitators, and there are people that are not so good at the skill. And so we're not saying that just because it's horizontal, that doesn't mean that it's not, that there's not an order to it, or that there's not a logic to it. It's just that it's not based on position and power and authority.
Right. Okay.
Okay. And so yes, some people might use the facilitator role to create a bureaucratic hierarchy or some sort of
or to become authoritarian themselves.
Order. Yeah. What's up?
To become authoritarian themselves. I mean, that's
yeah,
what I had observed.
Exactly. So, I mean, of course, that can always happen. People are not perfect, and
sure.
So whatever structure you create, people will always make mistakes. Now, with that being said, going back to something you said in terms of calling on some people and not others. Now, that could be an intentional practice in which you're trying to make sure that all the voices are heard. So if, for example, I'm a man, so if a lot of men have been talking in the meeting, the facilitator can say, okay, look, we've had this identity speak a lot. We need to hear other voices. So I'm not going to let you talk right now, and I'm going to wait for other voices to fill the room. So I'm going to call on someone of a different identity, whatever,
right,
to make sure that it's more inclusive. So sometimes when you see that kind of skipping some people and calling on others, sometimes that's an intentional move to actually foster community and to actually help all the voices be heard. But I agree, and I admit that we always have to be self-reflective.
Sure.
And that's the point that we're at right now. If you don't mind, I'd like to kind of tell you a little bit about, you asked me last time what was next, and I think this conversation is actually leading into the very conversations that we've been having within the movement. Because some of our practices and some of our models, some of our rhetoric, some of the things that have tied us together just haven't worked or have been oppressive. We've identified something very key, the General Assembly with 100 people and with people coming and going and anybody can come in, that maybe that tactic has had some flaws in it. And it's time to now reevaluate what we're doing and to make sure that this is still a dynamic, creative movement. We don't want to, I didn't join this, and the anarchists who set this up didn't create this to become an institution or to become some sort of organization in a bureaucratic sense. And unfortunately, I think we've begun to institutionalize, to become rigid in certain practices. And so now the time has come to begin to do that self-reflection and to perhaps radically alter the internal dynamics, structure, and rhetoric of the movement. And that's where I'm at, and that's where a lot of people are at. And if I may, I'd like to say that for me, I am now organizing to end occupation in rhetoric and as a name for this particular movement. I'm saying that for a number of reasons, and there are a lot of people that have been saying this. Occupation is a tactic, but not an effective movement strategy. So for most people, occupation means a violent military colonization of their land, their culture, and their mind.
Right.
And so
Robert, we got to hit a break here. Can you stick around?
Yeah, I can.
Stick around. Let's continue this conversation. Hang on. Robert Stevens II is with us. He's a law student and a member of Occupy DC, OccupyDC.org. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
More in just a moment about how the Occupy movement is doing, how it's changing, what they're up to, what their philosophy is, at least through the lens of Robert Stevens II.
Hello, Miss Mountain Girl. Tell me that you like it, yeah.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and we're talking with Robert Stevens II, a member of Occupy DC, as well as a law student. OccupyDC.org is their website. Robert, we in the first segment we were talking about the you know, the way these things are structured. I'd like to get into this discussion, this debate, frankly, between Chris Hedges and we had him on as a guest, but I don't have. Oh, David Graeber. That's right.
Yeah.
And Chris Hedges saying black bloc tactics and, you know, kids smashing, young people smashing windows in Oakland and things like that are a cancer within the Occupy movement. And David Graeber, on the other hand, saying a diversity of tactics is something that has characterized all movements in the past. And that's a healthy thing. And then Chris Hedges rebutting, saying, no, actually, that diversity of tactics has retarded various movements in the past and caused what could have been a 10-year movement to be a 20 or 30-year movement. And I'm just curious where the Occupy movement, in your opinion, and I realize that you're not an official spokesperson. There officially are none, I suppose, for any of these groups. But you're very involved with this. What are your thoughts on this? First of all, let's define terms. Diversity of tactics and black bloc. And then just go off. We've got about 5 minutes here.
Okay. Well, first, diversity of tactics is pretty much exactly how it sounds. It's basically creating a space as a movement where people feel like they can be creative and they can be dynamic and adapt to the situations at hand.
But isn't it also code for some people can be violent?
No, I'm saying diversity of tactics means that people can be creative and respond to the situations that they're presented with.
Well, let me rephrase that. Isn't it code for some people can commit vandalism?
I'm saying, here's the thing. The discussion about diversity of tactics has almost nothing to do with violence explicitly.
I'm talking about vandalism.
Violence is a separate conversation, and sure. I'd like to talk about that.
Okay.
Like, diversity of tactics would be, it's just what I said, opening up space where people can be creative and respond to the situations at hand in a way where we can maintain solidarity and have discussions about which tactics are smart and which tactics are not smart. That's the dichotomy, not about, like, are young people going to go out and smash windows, but what's a smart tactic? What does that look like in the current situation? And the current situation, now this is the violence piece, the current situation is that we live in a very violent, repressive regime as far as what the United States government, and not just the United States government, but what this corporate power structure is a very violent structure. Like, for example, and that's why there's been pushback against the use of the term occupation. That is a violent term. And so, like, you look at a city, an Alabama city a couple years ago, was plowing over a Native American burial mound in order to build a Sam's Club. That's violent. You know,
what good is there to the Occupy movement using vandalism as a tactic? When is that a useful thing?
I'm saying we have to put things in perspective. Compare vandalism to, and I wouldn't even call it vandalism. We're talking about Strike was painted on a window, and a Whole Foods, who has been exploiting workers and pushing down wages,
right,
had their tables turned over. Okay, that's what happened in Oakland. A few people did that.
Well, and there were windows smashed as well.
Okay, so compare that to the fact that we have a violent state that has sent in police to beat people, that has created an economic structure that has spread poverty and spread.
So you're suggesting that the violence of the state justifies vandalism on the part of the Occupy movement?
I'm not saying that it justifies it. I'm saying that what you call vandalism pales in comparison to the true violence that we experience.
I don't disagree with that at all, but I'm asking whether
the debate is whether what you call vandalism is a smart tactic.
Right.
Now that's the debate. But to act like that was an episode of violence in a vacuum, independent of an overall savagely violent power structure, it would be unfair. And that's.
But you're not condemning that.
I will say this, in Oakland, the statistics are in. When the Occupy encampment was there, the so-called hyper-violent encampment, crime was down in the location. People felt safer. There was participation in community there, and violence wasn't an issue. And for people who
isn't the big statistic that when those UC Davis students sat down nonviolently and were pepper sprayed, that affection for the Occupy movement and identification with all across America spiked. And when young people in Oakland smashed windows and spray painted a couple of stores in the Bank of America, that identification with and affection for lack of a better word, the Occupy movement dropped. And you're losing support when you do that. Why do it?
Hear this. When there are people of color beaten and killed in cities across this nation, and no one cares. They suffer, they die, they're incarcerated, and nobody cares. So to think that if we suffer, we're going to automatically reach the hearts and minds of people and propel them and inspire them to action is not.
Well, that's what Martin Luther King did. He said, let's just suffer in a large, invisible way. We'll stand with those people, and instead of just one
there's
person.
A diversity. Well, if we want to talk about the civil rights movement, two things are important. One, there was a diversity of tactics and strategy, and two, the traditional institutional structures that the civil rights movement created were hegemonic and repressive to women, to gay people. Like, Ella Baker was marginalized and pushed to the background.
Okay.
They had Rustin was marginalized and pushed to the background.
Yeah, I'm sorry, the reality of commercial radio and clocks and things has hit us. We're out of time, but people can read more about it at OccupyDC.org. Robert Stevens II, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm curious your thoughts on diversity of tactics and where the Occupy movement should go. Thank you. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. Is that different from anarchy? I think so. 34 minutes past the hour. And our conservative alert for the day, Tucker Carlson calling for, we had, Robert Stevens just talking about, Robert Stevens II just talking about a violent society. Listen to this. This was on Fox so-called news. Tucker Carlson talking about Iran.
Tucker, aren't we the only country allowed to make preemptive strikes?
No, we're not.
Who the hell does Iran think it is?
Actually, I know you're sort of kidding, but I agree with that. I think we are the only country.
No, I'm not kidding at all.
We are. That's absolutely right. The only country with the moral authority sufficient to do that. The only country that doesn't seek hegemony in the world. I do think, I'm sure I'm the lone voice in saying this, I think Iran deserves to be annihilated. I think they're lunatics. I think they're evil.
Amazing. We're the only country that doesn't seek hegemony. Apparently, Tucker has never visited Finland or Denmark or Sweden or Norway or most of the EU. Most of the countries of the world are not trying to create a worldwide empire. And Tucker, just for the record, we are signatories to the United Nations, to the various treaties that make us members of the United Nations. And they explicitly say that we do not have the right to strike another nation except in self-defense. When George W. Bush started dropping bombs on Afghanistan and later on Iraq, it was in violation of the United Nations. And in fact, in the case of the invasion of Iraq, it was in direct violation. It was an international war crime. It took 6 months for the UN to pass a retroactive resolution giving us the authority to do what we had done 6 months earlier, which is, you know, genuinely bizarre. Benedict in our chat room, I thought this was an interesting comment. He says, and just for the record, I just want to say this. And he says, Tom needs to get out there and get knocked around in gas so he has some real street cred when he talks about this nonviolent stuff. This Monday morning quarterbacking is way too easy. All right. Back in the 60s, 68, 69, I have been tear gassed. I have had rubber bullets shot at me. I was arrested. They shaved my head. They took me into the jail. They sprayed me with DDT. They used to do that, de-louse people. Got my body probed, shall we say. It's no fun. I can tell you, I've been there. I've been through it, and I've been through it more than once. And back when I was in SDS in East Lansing, and I understand what these young people are going through. And I understand the debate because some very good friends of mine split off, or some very good acquaintances of mine, I should really say. But in any case, people that I knew split off from SDS in East Lansing and joined the Weather Underground. And one of them went to prison for a long, long time till the end of the Bill Clinton administration. And we saw what happened when the Weather Underground started getting violent, which is not, by the way, what Robert Stevens was talking about. But still, we saw what happened. And we also saw, you know, I was there, and I remember the police infiltrators. I remember the ones that we were able to identify. And I remember, you know, a decade later when we finally got the the Red Squad reports from the Michigan State Police Department, one of the members of SDS, I don't recall if it was, I think it was Mike Price, it might have been Brad Lang or some, one of the other people, actually sued and got them. And there were our files, and there were the files of the infiltrators, the police infiltrators. And the one that I remember the most vividly was the guy who was always calling on us to use Molotov cocktails and to, you know, kill the pigs was his favorite phrase. And, you know, everybody took it as rhetoric. But I think that there was a – well, I guess I've said enough about that. We'll just – time for your thoughts. Mark in Essington, Pennsylvania. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, you know, you just stole my thunder because I actually had called about the historic infiltration of these movements in the United States by the police and by the FBI.
And there's a third group, by the way, and let me point this out, Mark, and I saw this in the 60s, and I think that we're seeing it again, too. There are also people who are ideologically who don't believe in representative democracy and in a republic. They believe in an absolutely horizontal society with no authority figures, and the modern incarnation of them call themselves anarchists by and large. Back in my day, they called themselves Trotskyites or communists, or you know, some of them had very, very slight, very narrowly defined definitions or words that they used to define themselves, and they were, you know, calling on us to tear down the university, tear down the local businesses. The police were an unelected, an unrepresented authority, and the United States government itself should be torn down and replaced simply by local governments or no governments. And that kind of infiltration was going on as well. And we have to acknowledge that. Pardon my interrupting you. Back to you.
That's all right. I mean, these people that do this, you know, they're out there just to destroy this movement. You know, because I really feel for these people.
Yeah.
They need, and I do feel that they also need to have some kind of structure, some kind of organization, and maybe a head, you know, a leadership.
Well, we're going to get into that in the next hour. There is a group out of Philadelphia that is calling itself the 99% Declaration Group, and they're planning a national general assembly, and they want to actually have people run for public office, and they want to petition the government for redress of grievances. And the Occupy movement is officially disavowing them, saying, no, we don't recognize the legitimacy of the government of the United States. And
they should recognize the government.
Well, we'll see. I mean, you know, I'm in that regard, I'm watching this and reporting on it and sharing these folks' perspective with you. You just heard from somebody from the Occupy movement. You're going to hear at the top of the next hour from somebody from this 99% Declaration movement. And we're starting to see the schism here, and I'm not celebrating that at all. I think, though, that there is a natural evolution in all movements, in all political parties. It happened in the suffrage movement. It happened in the abolition movement. It happened in the civil rights movement. It happened in the early days of the American Revolution, where it's like a relationship. You begin, and it's like, oh, we're identical. Everything's wonderful. We agree on everything. It's the honeymoon, right? And then things start getting serious. Then things start getting real. And then you discover, oh, no, you think differently than I do. And you have different strategies than I do. And then and then sometimes it breaks into open confrontation. And then eventually, you know, you reach a point where, and this is, you know, what true love is, or true relationships are, or true movements are, where you embrace the diversity and you say, okay, you're different than me. We think differently. And yet we can work together toward a common goal. And
well,
I think the
Tom.
Occupy movement is moving in that direction. So anyhow, Mark.
Oh, and by the way,
yeah,
I do live right outside of Philly.
Okay, so check it out. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Jeff in North Providence, Rhode Island. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, great show. I always appreciate it, even though I am a libertarian. But I always really religiously watch your show. It's
okay.
Great for information. But this is regarding the Occupy movement, and if they want to go one level, or the 99% movement, whatever they want to call themselves, if they want to go one level beyond what they're doing right now, there are technological things that they can take advantage of. There's Google Earth, there's GOI, which is a subscription service. There are public records, property records, car registration records, and so forth, you know, registrations with the Secretary of State as far as corporations go, and use that information and publish it on a website, put it on a website regarding those people who are the corporations or the businesses or the banks or the banksters or the financial institutions or the defense contractors that they don't like.
Right, so what you're suggesting, Jeff, is instead of using what I refer to as vandalism, rather than using that as a tactic, use shaming, basically public information as a tactic. I got it. I think that's a very good suggestion. Thank you very much. Let's see here. Carlos in Portland, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Carlos, what's up?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I've been participating in Portland, Oregon, in the Occupy movement here, and I just wanted to make a comment with respect to this general conversation with regards to tactic, and also the sort of divide within the left among tactic and ideology. But essentially all I can say is that from my observations, it seems that people on the ground, the boots on the ground, and the folks in the front line, regardless of whether or not they identify as radical, are coming to terms with the fact that the call for social and economic justice expressed by the Occupy movement resonates with the populist sentiment.
Yes.
And that this isn't a populist movement because of the legitimacy of one political ideology over another.
Yes.
And I think some people are kind of hung up on that because, and this ties into the discussion of strategy here on out and tactic and diversity of tactic, which personally I feel has become a loaded term, kind of like No Child Left Behind.
Mm-hmm.
But with regards to these conversations of strategy, people need to recognize that we're not here to grow the flock of any one ideology or the other. We're here to try and coordinate with each other and tackle a very fundamental problem. And I think a lot of people are getting hung up on the desire to grow their respective flock, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, you get some people who are into movement building, and you get other people who are into direct action, and you get other people who are into, you know, goal setting, and yeah, I mean, welcome to the human family. You know, it's messy. Democracy, small d democracy, or anarchy, or whatever you want to call it. You know, people coming together to try to advance social justice. It's messy. And that's a good thing, in my opinion. I think that's a healthy thing. I think it's a very healthy thing. Carlos, thanks for sharing, and thanks for participating.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more thoughts on the future of the Occupy movement and the movement politics in general in the United States right after this. Opposing the con and conservative, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Les in Glendale, California, listening on KTalk. Hey, Les, what's up?
Hi. I'd like to make a suggestion for what I think should be the or could be the next step for the Occupy movement.
Mm-hmm.
Step one was very successful. They got the discussion in the news. They got national coverage. A lot thanks to you, too. So everybody got that, but sitting out and camping overnight is not for everybody. So as step two, I'd like to see them organize around a politician's office, to go to our representatives and their state, the senator offices, and hang out all day long. We can do it then, you know, at normal sort of hours, with a very specific goal, like I want the representatives to do something, and I would say something like signing on to Ted Deutsch's constitutional amendment to get money out of politics, to end corporate the
Here's the problem with that, Les. the problem with that, and I encourage you to go show up at some of these Occupy movements and participate. If you do, what you will discover is there is a not insignificant fraction in some Occupy movements, the majority, who do not recognize the legitimacy of an elected politician. And therefore, they will not go to that politician's office because they believe that our government is illegitimate, the politician is illegitimate, and it all needs to be brought down.
Well, that's disappointing because that's just not realistic.
From your point of view, from the point of view of somebody who's, you know, 2021 and is kind of fresh into the world, it just sounds so cool to have, you know, imagine a world with no government. Imagine a world with no authority figures. Imagine a world where nobody's in charge. We're all in charge. It's a very, very appealing sales pitch that a lot of people in the Occupy movement and this is the basis from which they justify this, quote, diversity of tactics, end quote, which means some of us will do nonviolent sit downs, some of us will march, and some of us will break windows. And because, hey, it's just property, and breaking property, harming property is not violence. It's not harming people. And this is the debate that the Occupy movement has to have within itself right now, and they are having, actually. And frankly, I think more of us need to show up, participate, and be engaged in that debate. So, Les, thanks for the call. Frederick in Calistoga, California. Hey, Frederick, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'd like to hop on to the conversation about what's next as well. You know, the left has a vacuum as to where we're going. The right since Goldwater has known that they're interested in privatizing America's commons. You know, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all the way down to K through 12 and university education. The left does not understand that. The left does not understand that, really, many of us are beginning to see that we have our dependence upon democratic control and ownership over the key components of our society, like our public lands and public education, public energy and public health care. But until we start to trumpet that which we hold in common, you know, the commons, the commonwealth, and the common good, I think that's the frame or the vision that the left must begin to adopt and move away from, Tom. We need to move away from these myopic positions like the gay and lesbian marriage equality movement and the environmental movement and the 350.org, as well-meaning as they all are. They all depend actually upon a functioning democracy and good governance to assuage or to stop the egresses of capitalism and consumer economy.
Yeah, and so what do you do?
This April, I would suggest that we call for a National Day of Investment, and I'm working with the state, with friends back in the state of Maine, that we honor that which we pay our taxes to, that we rally around our public libraries and our public schools, our public kindergartens. We rally around our national and state parks and our beaches. And with that rally, Tom, we make a call for wise investment, a turn away from the egresses of corporate capitalism,
so,
and we begin
honor the commons. Frederick, I'm with you. Honor the commons is a great idea. Thank you very much for that. Vivian in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Vivian.
Hi, how are you doing? One of the things that I find is that our society has gotten to the point where when we go into a movement, everybody is for, oh, we're with somebody when they are fighting for a common good, and as long as they're nonviolent, we're okay. It's like, as long as they're not doing anything violent, then we're okay with them, and we're for them. We're not gonna go out there and do anything, but we're for them. And as soon as somebody in that movement do something that's a little violent, then we're shocked. And it doesn't matter that something has been done to someone in that group that has gotten them to the point where they're tired, they're angry, they're frustrated. We all of a sudden we want to talk about what has happened that they did something that was violent, yeah, and they're messing up
the whole movement.
You know what you're identifying, Vivian, if I may interrupt very, very briefly, is why Rosa Parks had been through 10 years of trainings within the civil rights movement and facilitating trainings. She was actually even teaching trainings before she confronted that bus, you know, that bus driver. And that's the kind of thing, you know, you have to be ready, you have to be prepared for nonviolence.
Exactly. And most of us are not.
Yeah.
Most of us are not. We get frustrated with everything. We pay, you know, we voted these folks in. They were supposed to represent us. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, what has happened, there is no representation. We have people in office that are raising their salaries. We're losing our homes. Our children are not getting a good education. We have no jobs, and we're tired.
And you know, the rich are getting richer in ways that are unimaginable. And you know, a quarter of the Fortune 500, the 400 richest people in America, pay no taxes. And the 400 richest people in America own more wealth than the bottom third of America. I mean, Vivian, spot on. Thank you so much for brilliant comments. Appreciate the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And is the movement changing? Is it evolving? Is it growing? Are there new parts to the movement springing into being, as it were? Michael Pollack is with us. He is the co-founder of the 99% Working Group. Their website, The 99, that's 99, two digits, declaration.org, and their Twitter, Connect Occupy. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me on.
So tell us what you're up to.
Well, we're kind of an offshoot of Occupy Wall Street. We started it in October in Zuccotti Park. And as you know, the Occupy movement believes in a local direct democracy model. We feel that to raise the Occupy movement and 99% movement to a national level, you have to use representational democracy, representative democracy. So we are doing a national, privately run election in conjunction with VoteNet Solutions, which is the leading company that does online internet voting, secure voting, to have a national general assembly the week of July 2nd in Philadelphia, and we're electing 876 delegates, two from each congressional district, also delegates from D.C., Puerto Rico, and the four U.S. territories.
Right. Okay.
And they will be convening that week in Philadelphia.
Now, when we announced that you were going to be on our program, we got an email from Occupy Wall Street, from Han Shan, who I guess is their press liaison, press at OccupyWallStreet.org, saying the 99% declaration and its call for a National General Assembly in Philadelphia in July is not affiliated with or endorsed by the Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street, and the organizers' plans blatantly contradict Occupy Wall Street's stated principles. They say many news outlets are running the story about what you're doing and conflating it with OWS. And they say instead, you guys are a not-for-profit corporation called the 99% Working Group Limited and are not endorsed by the. They're basically disavowing you. And
well,
they say.
I didn't realize one person could speak for the entire Occupy movement.
Well, apparently he can. And finally, he says the group's plan to select your group, to select delegates representing each congressional district to ratify a petition to present to the U.S. government, while threatening to run candidates for positions in this corrupted system, runs counter to OWS's commitment to direct democracy. It sounds like Occupy Wall Street is now, since you have said we're going to engage the political system of America, the Occupy Wall Street groups, at least in the case of the, you know, this press release that we got from the Public Relations Working Group of Occupy Wall Street, is taking the position that they will not and do not, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but it's by inference, I would suggest, I would argue that it seems like they're saying they're not willing to and maybe not don't even recognize the legitimacy of our government.
That may be. I mean, as you know, Occupy Wall Street is made up of as many people as have opinions. There's no hierarchy. It's not a monolithic organization. We started there. We started with five people. We have thousands of people involved in our separate movement. And it's true. We don't subscribe to the direct democracy model, and we do believe in our Constitution. We think that the only problem, or the main problem, is the corrupting influence of money. And we think that our Constitution and the way it was founded is the way to go. And we think that's where the solution is. And once you remove the corrupting influence of money and purchasing politicians who are trapped in this system of every 2 years having to run again and, you know, are offered to the highest bidder to write policies for these people, you're right. The system is completely corrupt, and it's not a democracy. We do not live in a democracy. We live in a corporate state. An oligarchy run by the corporations.
By oligarchs.
Oligarchs, yes. Yeah. And the wealthiest people. What we're proposing, and they're right, but we're proposing very specific resolutions for this problem that can be done. But because the politicians are unable or unwilling to regulate themselves, the people must use this mechanism in the Constitution called a petition for redress of grievances to say, you can't do it. The people are now telling you what must be done, which is why we're electing people.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're proposing, one of the things we have, the 99% declaration is an implementing document with 21 suggested grievances and solutions. And the first few relate to campaign finance reform, overturning Citizens United, ending corporate personhood. But what we're proposing is setting up, for lack of a better term, a blind trust, removing all campaign contributions from all sources except the United States Treasury. In other words, fully taxpayer-funded campaign financing.
Yeah.
So if you get enough petitions to get on the ballot for Congress, you get $5 million. If you get enough for the Senate, $10 million. I'm making up these numbers.
Sure.
They would be determined by the FEC and an independent panel.
Right.
Determining what a fair value is for an election in that particular
right. This is Bernie Sanders has been calling for this virtually his entire political career, and
right.
and also that anybody who uses the commons as part of their business model, in other words, radio and television stations and cable companies that use the commons of the airwaves or the cable companies that run their cables through the commons of our streets, that they be required to carry political. But, you know, politicians' messages, politicians who are running for office at no charge, rather than this incredible feeding. I mean, we're set up for a $3 billion feeding frenzy this November, and almost all that money is going to end up in the pockets of a half a dozen corporations that happen to own television media and cable media.
We have that. We're on debate number 20.
Yeah.
I mean, who benefits from that? It's in point 17 of the declaration. The FCC will require every television, radio station, what have you, in each district to allot equal time to each candidate.
Right. This
if
is,
they don't, the license will be pulled.
Yeah, this That's is back to, our, this is pre-87 when Reagan blew that up mm-hmm. by stopping enforcement of the Fairness Doctrine. And what you're talking about is going back to like the Nixon-Kennedy debates that were held nationwide commercial free.
Right. But we're saying that, you know,
at a
local politician
level.
Will get a set amount of money to run their ads, and they can pay for ads, but they will also be given free airtime
yeah.
to state their positions because their licenses are a privilege.
How do you respond to the we had for the, in the first hour of our program for a half hour, we had Robert Stevens II on, who's a law student and a member of Occupy D.C., who started at Occupy Wall Street. He was one of the guys that got arrested in front of Chase Bank, I guess it was. And mm-hmm. he was asserting that the system is basically illegitimate. Are you saying let's try to make it illegitimate rather than let's either ignore it or try to tear it down?
We're saying let's make it legitimate. We're saying let's go back to what was
yeah,
intended
make it legitimate.
By the founders and get the money out. I don't think, you know, the 55 people who originated, you know, the Constitution, 35 of which were lawyers, thought that politicians would end up being purchased in the way that's so blatantly purchased, where they have a 10% approval rating, but because of gerrymandering and money, they just get elected over and over again. I mean, I'm sure you've heard the statistic.
Yeah.
94% of the time, if you raise more money than your opponent, you win.
Yep.
I mean, it's disgusting, and it's got to end. And we think by gathering people together to come up with a petition of 10 solid points on what's wrong with this country and saying to the politicians, do it now, or you're going to be replaced, and give them 100 days to start doing it. Obviously,
okay, I got it. Michael, we're out of time, but people can read more all about it at the99declaration.org. Michael Pollack, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more. What is the future of the Occupy movement and people's groups splitting off, like the 99% movement? It just takes a little good, a little out the right. Elvis will be just fine. Elvis will be all right, all right. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Very interesting. I'm guessing that this is just one of many groups that are going to start rising up, and you're going to see them on both sides, frankly. There are going to be groups rising up saying, okay, that's it. We've had enough. The entire thing is illegitimate, and we're going to start, you know, we're going to go weather underground. And then you've got groups that are going to rise up and say, okay, we're going to go, you know, young college Democrats and everything in between. Time will tell. Time will tell. But this is the maturing stage of movements, frankly. And I see it as healthy. And I'm not endorsing anybody. I'm not endorsing the 99% working group, and I'm not endorsing – well, actually, I'll endorse both of them. I Occupy Wall Street, I totally, you know, endorse and love the idea of horizontal governance, and we are in a constitutionally limited representative Democratic Republic, and I think that trying to influence that is also a great thing as well. So I support both of them. Ember in Norfolk, Virginia, and I don't see those as inconsistent positions. Ember, you think that Michael Pollack is not right on his facts?
Well, Tom, I agree with you in that I do definitely support the idea of a General Assembly and the 99% declaration in it of itself. If you check out the blog that I have posted at the99facts.blogspot.com, mm-hmm. you will see a plethora of links to Michael's own words, mm-hmm. To words spoken to other people and about him, to words from the General Assemblies, et cetera. And you will find that, in fact, not only is he not supported by Occupy Wall Street General Assemblies, he's also not supported by Move to Amend. He's not supported by his own people. He fired his board of directors over the last couple of weeks, and everything that he is working on is spun.
Oh, very interesting. So so we got suckered in, is what you're suggesting, Ember. Let me check it out. Tell me again, what was the – I've lost my pen. Tell me again, what was the website?
It is the99facts.blogspot.com.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Ember. I appreciate the call. And we will check it out. Dave in Humboldt, California. Hey, Dave, thanks for listening to KGOE. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Been with you for an awful long time, though we haven't spoken in several years. I was a friend of Alice. And
I
am also
Alice.
Bertrand Russell when I'm able to get on the chat room.
Uh-huh. Great.
I'm active with all of the Occupy movements that we have up here in Humboldt, primarily the Humboldt State one, which is OccupyHumboldt.org. And, mm-hmm. We feel we've been talking for a long time, and we've come to the conclusion that we agree on just about everything, and that the time for talking is probably nearing an end, and we need to become much more proactive. And I'd say that we're for sure we all believe that corporations are not people. For sure we all believe that the big greedy special interests are exploiting us in so many different ways. We believe that gay people should have the right to marry. On almost everything that comes up on the liberal versus what we've got in government, we have a position. Right. So we're at a point of feeling we need to start taking some real steps to do something about it.
Right.
We're having meetings to explore that. The big one is coming up on March 1, which I guess nationwide is going to be a major day for the Occupy movement.
Well, it depends on who you talk to. I mean, some Occupy groups are saying, hey, wait a minute, there is no national Occupy movement. This is our local group, period. You know, we're all about horizontal and small and individual. And then there are people who are saying, oh, no, we're talking on behalf of the national. And then, like, you know, with Michael Pollack, you've got groups that are starting to spin off now. But Dave, I think that the time for action is here. The question is, what is the action? And that's not something that I'm here to dictate. I don't pretend to be all wise and all knowing, and I'm certainly not a leader of anything. I want this show, though, to be a nexus point where these kinds of conversations can be held sanely and intelligently, and, you know, on reflecting all dimensions of this thing.
We definitely want to do all that we can to end electronic voting and rigged elections.
Yeah, I'm there with you, Dave. But see, that requires you to acknowledge the legitimacy of voting for elected representatives. And there is a significant faction within the Occupy movement that believes that even the process of voting for an elected representative is in and of itself corrupt and illegitimate. And that's part of the machine that needs to be torn down. And that's, frankly, where I personally part with the movement, but I Absolutely. Respect that perspective, and I certainly understand it. I shared that perspective when I was 18 years old. I don't mean that like I'm patting somebody on the head or dismissing it. I've had a lot of different worldviews in my life, and I still honor all of them.
We all believe that the Patriot Act is taking its toll. That we are being electronically invaded in every way that they can.
Yeah.
And that's something we want to do something about and feel
we
can.
There you go. Dave, I'm with you. Thank you very much for the call. Wayne in Eugene, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Oh, good morning, Tom. I wanted to talk about hierarchical versus non-hierarchical movements or organizations. So, and I've, you know, had experience with them. We've got a non-hierarchical nonprofit social service agency here in town. It's been here about 30 years, and they do a lot of really great things, but it takes them 6 weeks to change a light bulb.
Sure.
Because, you know, they have a general assembly that anybody in the community can come to, or a general meeting, and things are decided in the general meeting, and it takes a consensus of all those people to decide anything.
Right.
And they just, it's impractical for large groups.
Yeah, if you're a small group, direct democracy works really well. It works well in a kibbutz. Communism worked, you know, kibbutzes were ideal communist societies. Fewer than 150 people, it always, you know, it generally tends to work, but historically, human communities have always split when they got over 150 people. Thank you, Wayne.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
There's actually a biological basis for this. As mammals, our brains are capable of knowing 150 people, but not more. It's pretty amazing.
The revolution will not be televised, but it's live and kicking online. Forget Fox and the major networks. They're way behind the times. It's Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Videos, blogs, and texts. From cell phones, webcams, laptops, and who knows what's coming next. The revolution is on its way. It's coming to a city near you. Check your local listing for time and place, and do what you have to do.
Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry in Stephenville, Texas. Is that right, or Seppenville?
Yeah, Stephenville.
Seppenville. Okay. Hey, what's up?
Stephenville. Yes, listening to the Occupy conversation this morning and thinking about the price of oil going out of sight again and our gas prices going up, I think for a long time that we've missed the whole point of all this thing. We should be occupying the oil companies and the traders.
Well, I think that, frankly, personally, I think we should nationalize the oil. We should say all the oil inside the United States is the property of we the people, and, you know, we're going to start selling it at OPEC prices to the oil companies if they want to buy it, rather than letting them drill it out of our ground and pay us pennies on the barrel.
Well, I could go all the way to that, but we might have a little trouble getting to that point, but
yeah.
Just nationalizing part of the income until we get the national debt paid off might be a start, but
yep.
One way we could do this is that when Mr. Obama, the pipeline that's supposedly coming down to Texas, or it could come, that instead of, I lived in Wyoming for a while, and Interstate 80 runs across the top of Wyoming and east and west, that we could bring the pipeline down just to Wyoming and not come through the sand hills of Nebraska and
yeah.
Put the plant in up there instead of bringing all this stuff to the Texas coast.
Well, there's actually already a Keystone pipeline which runs from the Alberta tar sands down to more or less St. Louis, Missouri, and then it runs east over to Indiana. And there are several refineries from St. Louis to central Indiana along the way on that, and they convert it into gasoline, which is sold in the American Midwest. And one of the concerns of not the environmentalists who just don't, you know, are saying we don't want that much more carbon going into the atmosphere, and not the people who are speaking on behalf of poor people who live in the Texas-Louisiana border area where you've got Cancer Alley from all these refineries, but instead just the people who are concerned about the price of gas, they're saying if you put that Keystone, that new pipeline going all the way down to the Gulf Coast, you're going to have more and more of this oil being exported, more and more gasoline being refined down there, less and less gasoline being refined in the Midwest, and it's actually going to drive up the cost of gas in the Midwest by 15, 20, 30 cents a gallon at the very least. So there, but that pipeline that you're describing already exists.
Well, I know. I've seen the map. But what I'm saying is that we have all this government land that a lot of the state of Wyoming and a lot of the West is owned by the United States already.
Right.
We just have it leased out to people for grazing. But you bring the pipeline down till you get to Interstate 80, someplace where there's a lot of water there, and someplace we already own the land, and the government puts the plant in. We own the plant.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying that if we took the same amount of money that they're going to use to build this thing, and instead we used it to jumpstart the solar industry in this country, you know, Germany just announced today that they're radically cutting back on the subsidies for people to put solar on the rooftops of their houses, because they now have something like 10 or 15 gigawatts, thousand megawatts of power being generated by solar panels on people's roofs. And this is Germany, by the way, is the cloudiest country in Europe. And yet they're producing now so much solar power that their grid can't handle it. They're not sure what to do with it. They've got to upgrade their grid before they can go any farther. And the price of solar, because of the initial government subsidies, they got 40 different companies now in Germany manufacturing and distributing and installing solar panels and competing with each other. And the price has been driven down to the point that they don't need the subsidies anymore. And that we should be doing that instead of talking about, right, you know, any kind of insane pipeline and burning carbon. It's just nuts. Larry, thank you for the call. Glenn in Southern Illinois. Hey, or is it South Illinois, Illinois? Is that the name of a town?
Southern Illinois, Tom.
Oh, just
the southern extremes of Illinois.
Okay.
I'd like to say first that I'm very much in favor of the Occupy movement, the folks there, what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
The way that they're going about it, and most importantly of all, I think the nonviolent approach that they've taken. But I'm very concerned about the gentleman that you talked to, the fellow, I think, was it Mike Pollack, the splinter group from the 99%?
Yeah.
The system tends to do this, whether knowingly or unknowingly. Either he's probably being backed now by people that are within the system and want to perpetuate it, or he will be in the future if he continues. My feeling is that the more splinter groups that they can get, the less focus there will be on the goals of the true 99%, which is to try to get rid of or change or replace a corrupt system that isn't working for the people.
Well, what are you going to replace it with?
I'm wondering what to do. I'm hoping that the Occupy
Glenn, hang on just a second. What are you going to replace it with?
I think there needs to be some sort of a hybrid that takes the best of socialism and the best of capitalism and puts them together, because...
But capitalism is an economic system. It's not a political system. And
pardon?
Capitalism is an economic system. It's not a political system. The political system that we have is a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic. What do you want to replace that with? I realize
there's nothing wrong with the fact that we elect people, but we need to change the focus so that it is no longer on money or capital, but it is on the people and their benefit. And,
I totally agree with you. But there are, and this is one of the big debates that's happening in the Occupy movement right now. There is a not insignificant fraction of the Occupy movement, or some of the Occupy movements, who are saying the government of the United States itself is illegitimate. That, you know, representative democracy doesn't work. It has failed. It needs to be taken down. And my question is, okay, what are you going to replace it with? And I haven't heard an answer to that question yet. And until I do, I guess I'll just keep asking the question. Glenn, thank you for the call. Bob in Homeworth, Ohio. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind?
I'm glad to have you on here. And you're very educational.
Thank you. What's on your mind today, Bob?
On my mind, I've been watching the show for about the last 2 weeks or something like that. Mm-hmm. And even since the time that they signed this thing, the Republicans, they had to have this meeting to say, "In God we trust."
Right.
You know? And the religious right pushes this. And if it's in God we trust, why do they want to spend so much money on defense?
On war.
You know?
Yeah. Well, on because war, right. they say in God we trust, but what they really trust in is Lockheed Martin and Boeing and the other defense contractors out there and the possibility of war. Thank you for the call, Bob. You raised, you know, one of the really important questions of the day. Randy in Bellingham, Washington, listening on KBAI. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Morning. I have a suggestion for the Occupy movement and everyone else that's listening. I think one thing we can do is take the time to call into conservative talk radio and state our positions. You know, one thing I do or what people could do is listen to Tom Hartman in the morning, get the facts, and then take half an hour of your day and call into conservative radio. And
good luck.
You know, take...
You know, a lot of those guys, their call screeners will not let contrary calls through. I mean, we even have a dedicated phone number, you know, 866-745-CONS for conservatives to call in. Uh-huh. If you disagree with me, you always go on first. I think that that's, you know, healthy. I love healthy debate. But if you try to call into Limbaugh's program or Hannity's program or whatever, and you disagree, and they will put you on the air if you sound like you're drunk, or if you sound like you're really young, or if you sound like you don't have a clue what you're talking about, and they can make it look like the opposition is stupid or uninformed or uneducated. But if you call and you really have your talking points and you really understand what you're saying, you will never get on the air on these right wing stations.
I guess I'm
you got to
really
fake your way onto it, basically.
I'm lucky in my town because I have a station that does take my calls.
Oh, okay, so you got a local host, a local right wing host.
Yeah, and I found that if you're informed and take a lesson from you, if the people, if you're informed, polite, respectful, and non-argumentative, and just give them the facts, like Sergeant Friday used to say,
yeah.
that it does work.
No, you're,
I think everybody can do some good that way.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and on a local basis, you know, like Lars Larson in Portland, he and I were the two Portland guys for a while, you know, when I was doing the local Portland show.
I listened to him, in fact.
Yeah.
I was going to mention
those calls. And yeah. I respect that. I respect Lars for that. And there are other right-wing talk show hosts around the country. Michael Medved will do that. He's one of the few national hosts who will take progressive calls. But a good point, Randy. In other words, get active. And don't just confine it to that. Also consider things like writing letters to the editor of the newspaper, posting on blogs, showing up at events, showing up at Occupy events, joining organizations like Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, and others. Thank you, Randy, for the call. Great to hear from you. Randall in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Randall, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's an honor and a pleasure. I do watch every morning.
Thank you.
I'd like to talk about illegitimacy, illusion, and the Illuminati. In 1913...
We got a minute, by the way.
The Federal Reserve was pushed on us through corrupting our politicians. Within 20 years, we had the Great Depression and we were bankrupt. So they had to give a law saying that we had to give our gold, silver, and other resources back to the government so they could give to the lenders to perpetuate the government system. Now, when you have a birth certificate, they immediately make a straw man corporation, which is sold on the stock market to the Bank of England. And we use maritime admiralty law in our courts and not civil law due to this fact. People don't understand this at all.
Yeah,
when
Randall.
You go to YouTube.
Okay, the YouTube is what? Quick.
The truth about birth certificates.
The truth about birth certificates. Okay, thank you, Randall. Thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Helen Radner is going to drop by, give us an update on what's going on in the world today, and we'll be taking more of your calls as we move along. Okay, Helen Radner will be with us in just a moment. But first, Kirsten in Aberdeen, Washington, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Kirsten, what's up?
Oh, good morning, Tom. I would just like to posit as regards the Occupy movement that after 30, 40 years of studying and absorbing all things beautiful, which this is, that archetype that is so prevalent in any transformational movement, the archetype of ego, and I'd like your opinion on that, if you think that that's a part of this.
Of course it is.
For all of us. It concerns me.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. It concerns you how?
It concerns me in that there's a possibility to divide and conquer, and as with Gandhi, he was able to he was able to conquer those times in himself when that arose. And I think that we're looking at our own selves, having to look more closely at ourselves in being involved in this, and how, you know, this bardo of the ego.
Yeah, but here, Gandhi would not be accepted by the Occupy Wall Street movement because he was a leader. And this is, you know, and this, they're asserting that they're a leaderless movement and they don't want leaders. And not only that, you know, Gandhi, you know, as a leader, he did some pretty remarkable things, but he also did some, did you know that he called up Winston Churchill and said, why don't you just give in to Hitler? Why are you fighting this guy? You know, you're promoting unnecessary bloodshed. Just let Hitler take England. And, you know, I'm not sure I would have been with Gandhi on that one. But anyhow, Kirsten, thanks very much for the call. This is a time that we need a lot of communication and a lot of discussion around these issues, frankly. And thank God that the Occupy Wall Street movement has started and has begun many of these dialogues. And good on them for it. And we need to, more of us need to show up at these meetings and participate in this. Helen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by her new book, Self-Empowerment, written by Helen Radner and Ann Gaiman. Helen, what's up?
Well, okay, the president did send a letter to Mr. Karzai saying the U.S. officially apologized for the burning of those Korans. Now, two Americans were killed by, actually, it looks like, and we're just getting the details, a colleague of theirs who was in the Afghan military who sort of melded back into the crowd. But it does look like there were two Americans killed over this incident. I guess they were doing crowd control, and this took place in the Nangarhar province, which is in eastern Afghanistan.
So the religious blowback has turned violent, apparently.
That's for sure.
This is the horrible thing, Ellen, that happens when any country occupies another country.
I just remember Jim Pinkerton and myself and Shalene Espinoza were in Iraq 3 months afterwards. She had been there during the war, but we came in June. And Jim looked around and said, if we think as the United States that 10 years from now this place is going to be friendly to America, we're wrong. And he was absolutely prescient about it.
Yeah.
Because it's 10 years and look what happened.
Yeah, occupations don't work out well. There's lots of history for
that. Okay, the president is going to be making a speech this afternoon, and he's getting it from both sides on this front. This is about gas prices. He's supposed to do an all-of-the-above kind of strategy in terms of drilling, and he's going to go on his record of opening up more drilling areas. Alternative energy, increasing standards, that's what's been the White House song for the last few days. So that's what's going to happen.
I've got to share a stat with you on this, Ellen. Historically, fuel speculators, this is from a Wall Street report, historically, financial speculators accounted for 30% of oil trading in commodity markets, while producers and end users are 70%. a McClatchy review of the latest commitment of traders report from the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which regulates oil trading, shows that producers and merchants made up only 36% of all contracts traded in the week ending February 14th, while speculators who will never take delivery of the oil made up 64%. Speculators are what's driving up the price of gasoline in the United States.
It certainly is. And how about all these leases that haven't been used? Now, the United States, give it credit to the Obama administration, has wanted to say if you're not going to use these leases in X amount of time, they go away, basically.
Right.
Because that is exactly where you get the speculator market.
Yeah, yeah. And then the oil company, you're right. Yeah, they're buying and trading and speculating in leases as well.
Buddy Romer.
Governor
Romer is definitely gearing up to do his third-party candidate, and as you know, one of the things that he is on is campaign finance reform.
But he's going to run on the billionaire party.
Well,
or in the billionaire third party.
Yeah, of course.
What's it called? Americans Elect or something like that?
I had it, but you're right. I don't know the name. But anyway, he's gearing up, and he's got money.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the tax plan of the president is getting some right-wing hits on it, saying, well, this is just going to create more loopholes. And the reason that they're saying that, I know you're looking at me strange. Well, this is what they're saying. They're saying, well, the reason it's going to create more loopholes is because there's going to be so much more manufacturing that now is down to 25% as maximum tax under the president's plan. And so all these companies are going to say they're manufacturing companies when they're not. Now, that is a pretty hard loophole, but that is how the right wing is playing that one.
Hmm. Okay.
They're going to say, well, this is just going to be a
We're manufacturing hamburgers here at McDonald's.
Right.
Words.
Okay.
Well, you know, Ronald Reagan tried that. He, you know, ketchup is a vegetable and also,
right.
And when manufacturing numbers were dropping, actually it wasn't during the Reagan administration, it might have been the Clinton administration, but one of the administrations came out with numbers saying manufacturing is up, and they were counting hamburgers, making hamburgers as manufacturing.
It's amazing. Senator Schumer has now issued sort of invitation to Governor Brewer of Arizona. The Supreme Court is going to be hearing about the Arizona law. That's going to be taking place on April 25th. Senator Schumer wants to have a hearing on the Arizona law.
Are you talking about the anti-immigration law?
That's right.
Okay.
And he wants to, what he said in his letter is, as you frequently ask the President of the United States to visit the southern border to discuss border security, we expect that you'll be eager to engage in a productive dialogue with the Congressional committee responsible for acting on any border security recommendations you provide. That was sort of a nasty little whatever, but he's definitely involved in that. A Santorum, by the way, he is up in Oklahoma. He is up nationally. And I can tell you, Congressman Bob Ney said to me, listen, these people, if I were Obama, I'd be praying on my knees that
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, this is an interesting development. Mitt Romney, everybody says, won the debate last night, but the Rasmussen overnight polls show that he has dropped below 40% against Obama, slightly over 50%. In other words, he went down in the polls after the debate performance last night. I have this theory about the Republican Party. I have an analogous one about the Democratic Party, but just for the moment, the Republican Party. And that is that it goes in cycles of extremism versus moderation. That in the early, let's just start with the early 1900s, you had the progressive, actually, Republicans, the more moderate Republicans, the Teddy Roosevelts. Then in 1920, they were replaced by the radical Republicans, Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover, who crashed the economy, which brought back the moderate Republicans who cooperated with Franklin Roosevelt during the New Deal in the 30s, which then led to the radical Republicans of the Congress of 1946. They held power for 2 years in the United States House of Representatives, passed Taft-Hartley, refused to have a national health insurance program that Truman proposed, which then they lost the United States House of Representatives for 46 years. And which brought in the 1950s, the Eisenhower moderate Republicans. In 64, the Goldwater, the radical Republicans. In 1970, back to the Nixon moderate Republicans. 1980, back to the Reagan radical Republicans. 88, George Herbert Walker Bush, back to the moderate Republicans. 2000, George W. Bush, back to the radical Republicans. In 2008, the radical Republicans lost big. 2010, they came back with the help of the Tea Party. 2012. What's going to happen? I don't know. I honestly don't know. But Romney, in my opinion, represents the moderate wing of the Republican Party as much as he's trying to act like a right, like a hard right winger. And it looks like the Republicans are not going to stand for it. So let's ask one. Steve Malzberg is with us. Steve Malzberg is the talk show host, conservative commentator, radio talk show host. His website, malzbergtalk.com. And Steve, welcome back.
Hey, couldn't have said it any better. Thank you.
Is the Republican Party dying? Is the Republican Party going through a change? Are the radical, and I don't mean that in a negative way, are the highly conservative Republicans rising up and taking over, or are the moderate Republicans rising up and taking over? What's going on your side?
Well, I think right now everything's getting weeded out, and I think that's always a good, healthy process. I think in the debates, especially the last few, you know, Mitt Romney has come under every kind of attack he could possibly anticipate from Obama, so has Rick Santorum, and I think they both handled it very, very well. I think just because the people are equally enamored of Santorum and Romney, and you have your mix in there that favors Newt, and you got the nut jobs who favor Ron Paul, I don't think any of that is bad, and I think we make too much of the polls that they're, you know, they're taking every week, every day, every overnight, and it's this, it's that, and just about a month ago, Obama was getting beaten by Santorum and Romney and Newt, and you know, so it all will weed itself out.
And November is an eternity away.
What's that?
And November is an eternity away in politics.
November is an eternity away, but here's what the Republican, no matter who it is, will not be able to win if they run the campaign the way they ran it against, the way McCain did against Obama. What you need to do, first of all, you know, they talk about Republicans being out of the mainstream, and they talk about this contraception issue, which you know, Romney is on board with Santorum as well, as far as the quote unquote solution that Obama came up with the Catholic Church and organized religion. Well, who's out of the mainstream? Is that out of the mainstream, wanting freedom of religion, or a president who is on tape is saying, "I don't want my daughters punished with a baby"? A man who voted for infanticide in the Illinois state legislature, a man who couldn't bring himself to vote yes on protecting babies born of botched abortions.
So this is what you think is going to be the winning set of talking points for the Republican Party.
Winning, but this is something that has to be discussed.
Because I think a lot of Americans hear those talking points and they go, "What planet is this guy on?"
Say that again.
I said I don't think that that list of hits on Obama that you just listed, I don't think for most Americans they're going to say anything other than what planet is that guy on? And not talking about Obama, but talking about, you know, the Republican candidate who's quoting Steve Malzberg.
I don't know what you're talking about. Why, are you saying Obama didn't say these things?
Whether he did or not, I think
you want me to play you the tape? Have me on tomorrow. I'll forward the sound to your producer. I don't want my daughter punished with a baby.
I'm not telling you you're wrong, Steve. I'm saying that Americans don't care.
Really?
That when you take those things out of context like that and you try to demonize the president with these very, very narrow and tightly crafted wedge issues, that it doesn't, I don't think it's going to work anymore. I know it's worked in the past.
Right.
I don't think it's going to work anymore.
Right.
I don't think you can make people afraid of gays.
I don't think
you can make people afraid of Iran. I don't think you can make people afraid of black people. I don't think you can make Americans
afraid of black people. Maybe that's your goal. I don't know whose goal that would be, but
Rick Santorum was quoting the guy who wrote The Bell Curve.
Okay.
You know, which is a whole book about how black people are genetically inferior.
Rick Santorum's tied to that, right?
Well, he was quoting the guy.
How about David Gergen yesterday talking about all those white men on the stage? Donna Brazile, "I'm not going to let the white guys win." Tavis Smiley on NPR with Cornel West talking about yucking it up with Garrett Morris about how he used to tell kill whitey jokes. Maxine Waters talking about Boehner and Cantor, calling them demons. You want to talk about racists? Let's talk about racists,
my
friend.
So once again, Steve, I think that when you talk like that, what happens is Americans go, "Wait a minute, I don't want to have anything to do with this. I'm not there." That is like so far into the screaming edge of horror and paranoia that I don't even think the Republican Party wants to go there.
You brought it up, sir, with your tying Rick Santorum to hating black people or saying they're inferior.
No, I said that promoting the fear of any particular group, whether it's gays or African Americans or whether it's...
Who's talking about that? I brought up that Barack Obama...
I think Rick Santorum is, frankly.
He doesn't want his daughters punished with a baby and that he refused to vote to protect born kids. And you're turning it into gays and blacks. What are you talking about?
Or even abortion, whatever it is. I don't think these wedge issues are going to work for you guys.
Do
you think that the Republicans are going to have a brokered convention, Steve?
How about gasoline prices and the cost of electricity? Because we've seen the results of 3 years of Obama on that, and he predicted all of this when he was running in 08. He told CNBC, and I have this tape too, he's not concerned about the price of gas hitting $4 or $5. He just doesn't want it to happen too quickly.
Did you read the Wall Street Journal this morning quoting McClatchy on the Commodity Futures Trading Commission numbers that just came out?
I'm talking about what Obama wanted.
Historically, 30% of oil trading in the commodity markets is done by banks who are speculating. For the week ending February 14th, speculators who will never take delivery of oil made up 64% of all trades.
Good for them. But
it's
Obama
flipped the numbers upside down, which is why the price of gasoline is up in the United States, even though supply is up and demand is down.
But that's fine. But Obama himself said he didn't care that gas was $4 or $5. He just didn't want it to happen too quickly.
So you think you're going to win with that?
And on the cost of electricity, he said under my plan, energy rates will, by definition, skyrocket. This is what he wanted. This is what he knew would happen.
So
and now Americans are feeling
you really think the average American is gullible enough to take these singular, out-of-context quotes and believe that that's who this guy is and what he's all about when he's opened up more oil leases in three and a half years than George Bush did in eight?
So what does count if none of this matters? Speculators making money?
Well, I have a problem with speculators making money on oil. It used to be illegal. It was illegal up until 1999.
But you're telling me that the people, if it's put before them that Obama wanted all that's happened with energy and gas and wants it to get worse, that doesn't resonate with
Americans? I don't think Americans would believe that.
What do you mean they wouldn't believe it?
I don't think they believe it. You know, it hurts him politically when the price of gas goes up. And you're going to run around and say, this is what he wants. That's how it hurts him politically.
You're missing my point. Let me make it clear. We could play these fights because he said it.
And that's my point. I don't think Americans are going to listen to out-of-context clips and take them seriously.
Right. Gas will be $6 a gallon. You got the guy 4 years ago saying,
well, I know you want that, Steve. I know you want that.
Americans won't care.
Okay, MalzbergTalk.com. Right. You can get the whole story there. Steve Malzberg. Thanks, Steve.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. I think we just saw a preview of the November. It's not going to be pretty. Defending America from the Weapons of Mass Deception, Tom Hartman here with you. Ed Washington's on the line. He's with SEIU 1 in Chicago, a member of SEIU Local 1 in Chicago, Illinois, a janitor with the Chicago Public Schools. Ed, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Glad to have you with us. Tell us what's going on. The contract convention rally and March for Good Jobs?
Yes, sir. We're having a contract convention Sunday, which is February the 26th at the Chicago Theater, which is State and Lake, 175 North State Street.
Okay. And what's the goal of this convention? What's going on there? And who all are you inviting?
Well, we're inviting everyone, our families, our friends. The union president is going to be there, Arise Chicago. We're actually coming out to fight for better wages and better benefits, only for ourselves, but for the 99%.
There you go. So it's sort of like the micro and the macro for us and for everybody else. That's marvelous. And there's going to be not only this convention, but also a march you're going to have?
Yes, sir.
Tell us about that, sir.
Right. We're going to march down to Chase Bank, we're going to pass other banks who received bailout monies and didn't give anything back to the public itself.
Oh, interesting. And what can people do if they want to support what you're doing, Ed?
Oh, well, actually, you can come on down to the Chicago Theater on Sunday. We'll be down there at 12 noon. You can join the march. Or you can text JUSTICE1 to 787-753. You can follow us on Facebook, or you can even come to our website, www.SEIU1.org.
That's the digit one, SEIU1.org.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. A lot of great stuff. Ed Washington. Ed, anything you want to add?
Well, I just want everyone to come on down to support us, and we definitely need the 99% behind us.
There you go. Well, I think you've got the 99% with you, and I hope everybody within the sound of our voice in Chicago will show, or in nearby areas. You know, it'd be a great day. Hopefully Sunday the weather will be good. People can come on down and visit and have a good time. Ed Washington with SEIU Local 1 in Chicago. Ed, thanks so much for being with us today.
And thank you.
My pleasure. It's an honor, actually. Thank you very much for coming on. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Pete in Newport, Rhode Island. Hey, Pete, what's up?
Thanks for taking my call. You know, I'm kind of a little upset there when I was listening to the 99 occupants saying, we don't need a leader or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, if that's how they feel, that's good. But what I'm going to suggest that we need to do as the 99% is use this election to really shake things up. Mm-hmm. And the way that we can do that is when everyone goes to the poll, we should have done, even right at the local level, have our own poll, an exit poll. And that way they can't steal elections anymore like they did with Gore or anything like that. And, mm-hmm. of course, we're all worried about the electronic voting things. Why don't we take an exit poll and let the people speak? It won't be legal. They probably won't even recognize it, but we'll have our voices heard.
Yeah, it would be nice, Pete, if we just went back to having exit polls. They stopped doing them after the 2004 election. The 2000, 2002, and 2004 elections were the first time in the history of the United States that the exit polls didn't agree with the results of the voting machines. And
yeah, that's what I mean, dude. That's why we, as a 99% in Occupy Wall Street, right down to the local level.
Yeah.
At doing that.
Go out,
our results.
Do it yourself.
Have it monitored, everything.
Yeah.
And then have our results. They got to take notice.
Okay. I got it. I got it. I'm with you, Pete. I got it. I think it's a great idea. Thanks a lot for the call. Alan in Seattle listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Good. Great, but I'll get better. How's that?
That's awesome. I just want to acknowledge the work that you do. I always love to listen to you and the pearls of wisdom that you impart on the public that you you broadcast to. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
So there's a couple of things I want to say. You know, the Occupy movement, and you end your show every day with Occupy something. And, you know, I get, like, you're a supporter of the movement. But, you know, you even just said when talking to Helen, I don't know Helen's last name, the woman you speak to at the 11 o'clock hour, what's her name?
The woman that...
Oh,
Ellen Ratner.
The White House.
Ellen Ratner.
Oh, Ellen, excuse me. You even said to her, you were talking about occupying Afghanistan. Mm. You said to her, occupations don't work.
Yes.
So, Occupy, that you know, from a standpoint of being an American, I resonate more with We the People than mm-hmm. Occupy. And I think We the People movement is a movement that says by the Constitution, we the people of the United States of America, not Occupy, because Occupy does have this, like, we're taking something. You know, what we're not doing is we're not taking something. What we're doing is we're living up to our rights to speak as Americans. And I think We the People resonates to me more than Occupy. And
well,
so
it's a meme that is built into the DNA of Americans because it's the first three words of the Constitution. So I'm with you, Alan. Excellent suggestion. Thank you for the call. Nate in Minneapolis. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, big man?
Good. Got a minute.
It's a supreme honor always to be talking to. Well, I've only called your show two times.
Thank you.
This is the second. But I just want to say, man, you dropped the magic word today, collapse. Mm-hmm. And I just saw a documentary on a particular former L.A. police detective who talks about collapse. What's his name? Michael Rupert, the guy that basically showed up at that meeting and said, oh, hey, you know, your CIA's been dumping cocaine into South Central.
Yeah.
And he talks about collapse, and I had to ask you, man, what type of collapse do you think you see coming? Because you say we might be in it already, and I kind of agree with that.
I think we are. I think what we're going to see is something like the Great Depression. I think you're going to see the stock market crash. I think you're going to see we're already seeing the job market crash. The fundamentals haven't changed. You know,
and
we,
real quick, what like a Soviet Union style? You know what I'm saying?
Well, I sure hope
kind
not.
Of a nation.
You know, I hope we don't.
I mean, and you remember how the Soviet Union collapsed, though, and how it, you know,
oh, yeah.
how it's still Russia, but it's. You know,
well,
it was,
yeah, a lot of pieces of Russia went away. I mean, it was sort of that was their what they played out is what we almost played out with the Civil War. Only they fought, they didn't fight back, and the North did in the Civil War. I hope it doesn't go that way, Nate, and I doubt it's going to get that severe. But I think it's going to. I think we're in for some really hard times because the fundamentals haven't changed, and the banksters are still running the show, and they're nasty folks. Thanks, Nate.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and some new vocabulary word, ugly, and your calls. Yep, it's the good, the bad, and the very, very crassolinguously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. They're good. U.S. District Judge Carl Barbier. Judge Barbier ruled Wednesday that BP and one of its minority partners in the blown-up well site of the Deepwater Horizon explosion are liable for civil penalties under the Clean Water Act. Barbier also ruled that the owner of the Deepwater Horizon rig, Transocean Limited, may be liable under the same laws because it was the operator of the well. A ruling on whether Transocean can be held accountable as well will likely come sometime in the next couple of months. The Deepwater Horizon explosion of 2010 devastated the Gulf Coast's residents, its economy, and its environment. It's great to see that those afflicted by the disaster will finally be getting the money they deserve and the funds they need to rebuild their lives. The bad. State governments. The $26 billion foreclosure fraud settlement was intended to help those affected by the crisis, the homeowners. However, an increasing number of state governments are deciding to use their share of the settlement for other purposes. Reports already stated how Wisconsin and Missouri were going to use some of the money to fill budget gaps. Now Ohio is planning to use their share to demolish vacant homes. Pennsylvania wants to use the money to offset billions of dollars in program cuts, and Vermont plans to use their funds to balance the state budget. Even worse, Maryland is diverting 10% of the money it receives to let lawmakers do whatever they want with it. Settlement money is meant to make up for the devious actions of the banks. Using that money for anything else is just plain wrong. And the very, very ugly Arizona congressional candidate Gabriela Mercer. Mercer, a Republican candidate for Congress, told a group of Tea Party members yesterday that her opponent, incumbent Representative Raul Grijalva, was anti-American. Here's a clip.
His allegiance is not to America. Grijalva was born here, but he hates the American way.
It's not quite clear what evidence Mercer has to back up her outlandish claims, but the questioning of an individual's patriotism has become a common theme among members of the Tea Party. While personal attacks and slander campaigns are nothing new to the political arena, openly questioning the patriotism of an opponent and then flat out calling them anti-American and a traitor, that just really has no place in an electoral campaign and is very, very ugly. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Maurice in Bangor, is that Maine or Michigan?
Michigan.
Michigan. I didn't know there was a Bangor, Michigan.
Yes,
hey, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, come on. I knew there's a Dearborn.
Oh, it's near Dearborn?
No, but I know you're from Madonna's hometown.
Oh, you're near Flint.
It's on the west side. I'm on the west side of the state.
Oh, okay.
Over by Kalamazoo. South
oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm sorry. I grew up in Lansing, but I've not been through. That's you know. And when I was a little kid, my parents used to go to the secondhand stores all around. You know, we'd travel all around looking. My dad collected books and things, and I thought I knew every little town within 200 miles of Lansing, but I guess I don't.
Okay.
Anyhow, what's up?
Well, you had mentioned earlier about not knowing to one of the other callers what type of government to replace
mm-hmm.
our current government with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be theocratic. It's
oh,
going to happen.
Man.
You're
ruining my day here, Maurice.
Well, don't let that happen because you're on the right track, and this is propelling it. You're actually pushing us towards this happening. It's like the earth is about to have a baby and it's got to have its labor pains. And once the labor pains take place, I actually met three people that are of the same cloth of Jesus, the same cloth of Muhammad, the same cloth of Buddha in my lifetime. Yeah. And I was able to touch two of them. And the third one I only saw from a distance. But these people aren't bound by all the laws that we're bound by.
So you're talking rapture stuff. You're talking about Messiah is going to come back and run the government of the United States. Is that what you're saying?
No. They're not really predicted like Jesus was biblically. It's not that type of prediction.
But you see this as a good thing?
Oh, absolutely, because the loss of our fellow human beings to a lot of people would be a painful thing, but they will come back and they will be parented by people who are instructed by individuals. There's about 14,000 enlightened people on the earth right now that their lives are completely wrought by God. And you know, we don't generally know who they are because for the most part, if we did, our governments and our militaries, the minds of man right now would destroy these people.
Yeah, Maurice, all of that is fine with me. You know, I don't know if it's true or not. I have thought about it, but I think that to have anybody who represents themselves as being a religious figure or enlightened or whatever running our government, that spooks me. But Maurice, I got to move along, get some other callers in here. Thanks for the call. We all, frankly, need to be informed. I think that, you know, salvationist thinking, someone's going to save us, I think that's a little dangerous. Dennis in Tiffin, Ohio. Hey, Dennis, what's up?
Hey, before I get to what I called originally about the Occupy Wall Street stuff, but first I want to address this Steve Mars bot, Steve Mars nut, Mars quack, whatever that guy.
Yeah.
Oh, is that his name?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm a veteran. And it just, you know, I know for a fact the number of things that he said were not true.
Yeah.
I just want to point out to everybody that those that are serving were not too lazy to pick up arms, man ships, do all the ugly things associated with defending this country.
Yes, sir.
And the least any American can do is not be so lazy as to speak out in public without the facts at hand.
Well, I think what Steve was doing was he was taking statements out of context. He was taking and exaggerating them, changing their meaning.
The point is that they do it deliberately to prey upon those who are too lazy to get the facts on their own.
Right. And my point was I don't think that's going to work anymore. It'll work on Fox News, but there's only a couple million people watching Fox News, and there's 320 million people in America. And,
oh, I know, and I just want to put out to people that that's when people bring up bad facts on blogs and stuff like that and newspapers, that's my response.
Yeah, okay.
These people were not too lazy. You understand what I'm saying?
I do.
They were
absolutely
not too lazy to do all this stuff. Don't be so lazy as to not get the facts.
Yeah, I got you. Well said,
because
Dennis.
You dishonest their service.
Yes.
Now, about Occupy Wall Street.
Yes, sir.
I know you're a fan of Tom Paine.
And
I am, too. Okay, so I don't know why they don't reference common sense on the origin and design of government.
Yeah, common sense.
And see, in just second and third paragraphs, and then reference the Federalist Paper.
Yeah, paraphrase what Tom Paine said in Common Sense. He said that because humans preceded the existence of government, government was necessarily a creation of humans, and therefore it must be subordinate to the individuals who create it in all cases. Am I accurately characterizing the second and third paragraph of the opening of Common Sense?
Well, but that's in the introduction. I mean in the second segment, which is on the origin and design of government.
Yes, sir.
And which he speaks about the first peopling of the earth.
Yes.
Right? And how they have to help each other out.
Yes.
Okay, but as all but heaven is impregnable to vice, time will come where those who get ahead will be remiss in their obligations to those who follow.
Yes.
In more words or less, paraphrase.
Yeah, and here we are.
And then
here
he goes on, and he explains a few other things, and he says, you know, some people will be left to a state of living in which they would be said to perish rather than to die.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and so the insinuation is
is that we have an obligation to ensure that everybody in the democracy lives forward to kept. And we have to remember that a good 40% or more of the population was read, had read, or was aware of the content of this pamphlet.
Yeah. No, it was very widespread. In fact, actually, I would suggest that
it was the inspiring document that many colonists used to decide.
You're absolutely right. Although, actually,
separate from the colonies.
Common sense actually followed.
And direct democracy.
Yes.
The problem comes.
Yeah.
This is why we have to have representatives. It's, for example, I'm an expert in computer technology. Okay, but I'm not an expert in certain other things. I therefore would not have a qualified opinion on certain subjects.
No, Dennis, you're absolutely right. Thank you for the call. Well said. And people should read Common Sense. They also should read the pamphlet that Tom Paine wrote before he wrote Common Sense, which was called The Crisis. That's the one with the famous quote, "Now is the time that tribesmen's souls, the summer soldier and the sunshine patriot, will no doubt shrink from the service of their country, but tyranny like hell is not easily conquered," and or words to that effect. And people should read Agrarian Justice, which I think was the Tom Paine's most important work, and it's probably his most obscure. Herbert in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. We got a minute to the break, Herbert. What's up? Herbert? No, Herbert.
Yeah.
Hey, you're on the air. Got a quick one?
I was waiting so long, I forgot. But, now, the fellows, that couple of them that were on a little while ago, saying that the system, there is absolutely nothing the matter with the system. It's one of the finest that's ever been created. We just need the men to follow the system, and that's what we're not doing, and that's why we've gone so astray.
Men are so you think we need to fix the people, not the system? We need an awakening of morality or recognition of the importance of we're all in this together in this country.
We need to change society.
Yeah.
That's where the change needs to come.
I think you're right, and I think that the system in a way reflects society. I think when Reagan came into office and said greed is good, basically, that he fundamentally changed our society, and it's harmed us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the solution, of course, is to roll back the Reagan Revolution, roll back the Reagan tax cuts, roll back Reagan stopping and enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, everything else, basically, undo it.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of decay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. David in Macomb, Illinois. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Well, you're incredible, Tom. You have a good program.
Thank you.
I really try to watch it as much as I can. But I mentioned watched your program about the Occupy and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed about whether it was the Vietnam protesting or the union protesting throughout time. I noticed that the Occupy movement going on right now, in contrast to the Tea Party, what kind of treatment did the Tea Party get by the police establishment?
Oh, they were very nice to the Tea Party folks, because the Tea Party folks, they had the millionaires and billionaires behind them, so they bought permits. And they brought in these you know, $500,000 sound stages and put them up, and they had $500,000 buses that were all nice and fancy painted, and they had their own security. And I mean, you know, you got a lot of money, you can do things in a way that and most of the people were in their 50s and 60s who showed up, and so the police were just fine with that. They treated the Tea Party really well.
We see that as citizens in this country, and we know it's a big contrast.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the contrast has to do with who's got money behind them and who doesn't. And the Occupy people don't have money behind them, and the Tea Party people did. And so the establishment looks after its own. I don't know how to say it beyond that. Anyhow, thanks a lot for the call. Mike in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom, little victory. I've been fighting my doctor's office for over a year. Get rid of Fox noise in the waiting room.
Finally
get it.
Good on you. Congratulations.
They went to Discovery Channel, so.
Okay. Well, it's better than nothing. That's amazing. Okay, Mike, thanks.
Always better than misinformation.
Yep. So great story, Mike. Thanks. What it means is that, to all of us, if you see Fox News on Yeah, I've seen it in hotels and restaurants and bars and things. You know, they'll have Fox News on. And I always walk over and say, you know, I really don't like watching Fox News. Could you put something else on? I don't care what it is. A soap opera is fine with me, but just, you know, get that stuff off. And usually they make the change. Frank in Port Charlotte, Florida. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind? Frank? No, Frank. Okay, Mike in Lancaster, New York. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
How do you do, Tom? Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
See, I just had a quick question. In the event that that assault on women passes in the state of Virginia, will hospitals and clinics and doctors be required to notify the authorities and have police reports filed for every woman that has a miscarriage, no matter what the condition?
That's a very real possible outcome of the fetal personhood legislation. Whether it will go that far or not, I honestly don't know. But that's one of the objections by people in the medical profession is that they would then have to report every miscarriage to the police, or they would become forensic specialists. They would have to determine if the miscarriage might have been caused by the woman, you know, going out on a drinking binge the night before, or, you know, playing volleyball or something that she shouldn't have been doing if she knew that she was pregnant, and or even if she didn't know that she was pregnant. So it's
right.
it's a problem, Mike. Thanks a lot for the call. Earl in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Earl, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I was telling about Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
When he first ran for president,
mm-hmm.
his campaign slogan was "Elect me and I'll make things the way it used to be."
Oh, really? Is this the 76 primary race or the 1980 general?
The first time he ran for president.
So that'd be when he successfully ran, you mean, in 1980?
Right.
Okay.
First time he successfully ran.
Huh.
Now, up until Obama ran, I didn't vote because I didn't believe that the elections were fair.
Yeah.
And then when Bush got elected, the Supreme Court elected Bush, and then there was a lot of controversy on whether or not one of his elections was legal.
Sure.
That kind of proved my point.
Yep.
And then when Obama ran for president, I had to vote for that because being that he was the first black American to run for president, and by me being a black American, I had to do that. Now, his campaign and his presidency so far, the first one, is a lot of good things he wanted to do, but he wasn't allowed to do.
Well, and there's a lot of good things he actually did get done as well.
Yes,
but when you pointed, I didn't realize that Ronald Reagan's original campaign slogan was "I'll make things the way they used to be." But do you know where Ronald Reagan gave his first campaign speech after he was nominated by the Republican National Convention for president? His first, do you know where he gave his very first campaign speech when he was running for president?
No.
Philadelphia, Mississippi. Little town of 7,000 people. You know why? I'm assuming you're familiar with why Philadelphia, Mississippi is important.
Yes.
It's where those three civil rights workers were murdered, brutally murdered, and buried in the dike, and one of them was tortured, and they made it into the movie Mississippi Burning and other things, and Reagan gave his first speech in a little town in Mississippi, little town of 7,000 people, and it was a speech on states' rights. And in my opinion, that was all code for we're going to roll back civil rights legislation. And if his slogan was "I'll make things the way they used to be," I'll bet what he was talking about is we're going to undo the 60s. We're going to undo the Civil Rights Act. We're going to undo the Voting Rights Act. We're going to undo all those things, because that was certainly the subtext of his first speech. And that's amazing, Earl. It's amazing.
Well, a lot of people don't remember exactly how things used to be.
Yeah.
And I believe they were having air contrast controllers were on strike.
Yep, and he busted that, and he fired them.
He fired all them, and it's been like that since.
Yeah.
And I do believe if this keeps on going like it's going on, people, the Americans, that 99%, they're tired of it.
People are going to wake up. Earl, we're out of time, but thank you for your comments, and thanks for enlightening us about this. Coming up tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie. If it's Friday, it's Brunch with Bernie on the Tom Hartman program. Our national town hall meeting with America's senator. And check out his website, Bernie.org. That's his campaign site, Bernie.org. Be sure and check it out. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active, occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.